Chapter 1. Creators. In 1928, a cartoon character was born. An early Mickey Mouse made his debut in May of that year in a silent flop called Plain Crazy. In November, in New York City's Colony Theater, in the first widely distributed cartoon synchronized with sound, Steamboat Willie brought to life the character that would become Mickey Mouse. Synchronized sound had been introduced to film a year earlier in the movie The Jazz Singer. That success led Walt Disney to copy the technique and mix sound with cartoons. No one knew whether it would work, or if it did work, whether it would win an audience. But when Disney ran a test in the summer of 1928, the results were unambiguous. As Disney described that first experiment, "A couple of my boys could read music, and one of them could play a mouth organ. We put them in a room where they could not see the screen and arranged to pipe their sound into the room where our wives and friends were going to see the picture. The boys worked from a music and sound effects score. After several false starts, sound and action got off with the gun. The mouth organist played the tune. The rest of us in the sound department bammed tin pans and blew slide whistles on the beat. The synchronization was pretty close. The effect on our little audience was nothing less than electric. They responded almost instinctively to this union of sound and motion. I thought they were kidding me, so they put me in the audience and ran the action again. It was terrible, but it was wonderful, and it was something new." Disney's then partner, and one of animation's most extraordinary talents, Ub Iwerks, put it more strongly, "I have never been so thrilled in my life. Nothing since has ever equaled it." Disney had created something very new, based upon something relatively new. Synchronized sound brought life to a form of creativity that had rarely, except in Disney's hands, been anything more than filler for other films. Throughout animation's early history, it was Disney's invention that set the standard that others struggled to match, and quite often, Disney's great genius, his spark of creativity, was built upon the works of others. This much is familiar. What you might not know is that 1928 also marks another important transition. In that year, a comic, as opposed to a cartoon, genius, created his last independently produced silent film. That genius was Buster Keaton, and the film was Steamboat Bill Jr. Keaton was born into a vaudeville family in 1895. In the era of silent film, he had mastered using broad physical comedy as a way to spark uncontrollable laughter from his audience. Steamboat Bill Jr. was a classic of this form, famous among film buffs for its incredible stunts. The film was classic Keaton, wildly popular, and among the best of its genre. Steamboat Bill Jr. appeared before Disney's cartoon Steamboat Willie. The coincidence of titles is not coincidental. Steamboat Willie is a direct cartoon parody of Steamboat Bill, and both are built upon a common song as a source. It is not just from the invention of synchronized sound in The Jazz Singer that we get Steamboat Willie. It is also from Buster Keaton's invention of Steamboat Bill Jr., itself inspired by the song Steamboat Bill, that we get Steamboat Willie, and then from Steamboat Willie, Mickey Mouse. This borrowing was nothing unique, either for Disney or for the industry. Disney was always parroting the feature-length mainstream films of his day. So did many others. Early cartoons are filled with knockoffs, slight variations on winning themes, retellings of ancient stories. The key to success was the brilliance of the differences. With Disney, it was sound that gave his animation its spark. Later, it was the quality of his work relative to the production-like cartoons with which he competed. Yet these additions were built upon a base that was borrowed. Disney added to the work of others before him, creating something new out of something just barely old. Sometimes this borrowing was slight, sometimes it was significant. Think about the fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm. If you're as oblivious as I was, you're likely to think that these tales are happy, sweet stories, appropriate for any child at bedtime. In fact, the Grimm fairy tales are, well, for us, grim. It is a rare and perhaps overly ambitious parent who would dare to read these bloody, moralistic stories to his or her child at bedtime, or any time. Disney took these stories and retold them in a way that carried them into a new age. He animated the stories with both characters and light. Without removing elements of fear and danger altogether, he made funny what was dark and injected a genuine emotion of compassion where before there was fear. And not just with the work of the Brothers Grimm, indeed, the catalog of Disney work drawing upon the works of others is astonishing when set together. Snow White from 1937, Fantasia 1940, Pinocchio 1940, Dumbo 1941, Bambi 1942, Song of the South 1946, Cinderella 1950, Alice in Wonderland 1951, Robin Hood 52, Peter Pan 1953, Lady and the Tramp 1955, Mulan in 1998, Sleeping Beauty 1959, 101 Dalmatians 61, The Sword and the Stone from 63, and The Jungle Book from 1967. Not to mention a recent example that we should perhaps quickly forget, Treasure Planet, 2003. In all of these cases, Disney, or Disney Inc., ripped creativity from the culture around him, mixed that creativity with his own extraordinary talent, and then burned that mix into the soul of the culture. Rip, mix, and burn. This is a kind of creativity. It is a creativity that we should remember and celebrate. There are some who would say that there is no creativity except this kind. We don't need to go that far to recognize its importance. We could call this Disney creativity, though that would be a bit misleading. It is more precisely Walt Disney creativity, a form of expression and genius that builds upon the culture around us and makes it something different. In 1928, the culture that Disney was free to draw upon was relatively fresh. The public domain in 1928 was not very old and was therefore quite vibrant. The average term of copyright was just around 30 years for that minority of creative work that was in fact copyrighted. That means that for 30 years, on average, the authors or copyright holders of a creative work had an exclusive right to control certain uses of the work. To use this copyrighted work in limited ways required the permission of the copyright owner. At the end of a copyright term, a work passes into the public domain. No permission is then needed to draw upon or use that work. No permission, and hence no lawyers. The public domain is a lawyer-free zone. Thus, most of the content from the 19th century was free for Disney to use and build upon in 1928. It was free for anyone, whether connected or not, whether rich or not, whether approved or not, to use and build upon. This is the way things always were, until quite recently. For most of our history, the public domain was just over the horizon. From 1790 until 1978, the average copyright term was never more than 32 years, meaning that most culture, just a generation and a half old, was free for everyone to build upon without permission of anyone else. Today's equivalent would be for creative work from the 1960s and 1970s to now be free for the next Walt Disney to build upon without permission. Yet today, the public domain is presumptive only for content from before the Great Depression. Of course, Walt Disney had no monopoly on Walt Disney creativity. Nor does America. The norm of free culture has, until recently, and except within totalitarian nations, been broadly exploited and quite universal. Consider, for example, a form of creativity that seems strange to many Americans, but that is inescapable within Japanese culture, manga or comics. The Japanese are fanatics about comics. Some 40% of publications are comics, and 30% of publications' revenues derives from comics. They are everywhere in Japanese society, at every magazine stand carried by a large portion of commuters on Japan's extraordinary system of public transportation. Americans tend to look down upon this form of culture. That's an unattractive characteristic of ours. We're likely to misunderstand much about manga because few of us have ever read anything close to the stories that these graphic novels tell us. For the Japanese, manga covers every aspect of social life. For us, comics are men in tights. And anyway, it's not as if the New York subways are filled with readers of Joyce or even Hemingway. People of different cultures distract themselves in different ways. The Japanese in this interestingly different way. But my purpose here is not to understand manga. It's to describe a variant on manga that from a lawyer's perspective is quite odd, but from a Disney perspective is quite familiar. This is the phenomenon of doujinshi. Doujinshi are also comics, but they are a kind of copycat comic. A rich ethnic governs the creation of doujinshi. It's not doujinshi if it's just a copy. The artist must make a contribution to the art he copies by transforming it, either subtly or significantly. A doujinshi comic can thus take a mainstream comic and develop it differently, with a different storyline. Or the comic can keep the character in character, but change its look slightly. There's no formula for what makes the doujinshi sufficiently different. But they must be different if they are to be considered true doujinshi. Indeed, there are committees that review doujinshi for inclusion within shows and reject any copycat comic that is merely a copy. These copycat comics are not a tiny part of the manga market. They're huge. More than 33,000 circles of creators from across Japan produce these bits of Walt Disney creativity. More than 450,000 Japanese come together twice a year in the largest public gathering in the country to exchange and sell them. This market exists in parallel to the mainstream commercial manga market. In some ways, it obviously competes with that market, but there is no sustained effort by those who control the commercial manga market to shut the doujinshi market down. It flourishes despite the competition and despite the law. The most puzzling feature of the doujinshi market, for those trained in the law at least, is that it is allowed to exist at all. Under Japanese copyright law, which in this respect, on paper, mirrors American copyright law, the doujinshi market is an illegal one. Doujinshi are plainly derivative works. There is no general practice by doujinshi artists of securing the permission of the manga creators. Instead, the practice is simply to take and modify the creations of others, as Walt Disney did with Steamboat Bill Jr. Under both Japanese and American law, that taking without the permission of the copyright owner is illegal. It is an infringement of the original copyright to make a copy of a derivative work without the original copyright owner's permission. Yet this illegal market exists, and indeed flourishes in Japan, and in the view of many, it is precisely because it exists that Japanese manga flourishes. As American graphic novelist Judd Winnick said to me, "The early days of comics in America are very much like what's going on in Japan now. American comics were born out of copying each other. That's how the artists learned to draw. By going into comic books and not tracing them, but looking at them and copying them, and then building from them." American comics now are quite different, Winnick explains, in part because of the legal difficulty of adapting comics the way doujinshi are allowed. "Speaking of Superman," Winnick told me, "there are these rules, and you have to stick to them. There are things Superman cannot do. As a creator, it's frustrating to stick to some parameters which are 50 years old." The norm in Japan mitigates this legal difficulty. Some say it's precisely the benefit accruing to the Japanese manga market that explains the mitigation. Temple University law professor Salil Mehra, for example, hypothesizes that the manga market accepts these technical violations because they spur the manga market to be more wealthy and productive. Everyone would be worse off if doujinshi were banned, so the law does not ban doujinshi. The problem with this story, however, as Mehra plainly acknowledges, is that the mechanism producing the laissez-faire response is not clear. It may well be that the market as a whole is better off if doujinshi are permitted rather than banned, but that doesn't explain why individual copyright owners don't sue nonetheless. If the law has no general exception for doujinshi, and indeed in some cases individual manga artists have sued doujinshi artists, why is there not a more general pattern of blocking this free taking by the doujinshi culture? I spent 4 wonderful months in Japan, and I asked this question as often as I could. Perhaps the best account, in the end, was offered by a friend from a major Japanese law firm. "We don't have enough lawyers," he told me one afternoon. "There just aren't enough resources to prosecute cases like this." This is a theme to which we will return, that regulation by law is a function of both the words on the books and the costs of making those words have effect. For now, focus on the obvious question that is begged. Would Japan be better off with more lawyers? Would manga be richer if doujinshi artists were regularly prosecuted? Would the Japanese gain something important if they could end this practice of uncompensated sharing? Does piracy here hurt the victims of the piracy, or does it help them? Would lawyers fighting this piracy help their clients or hurt them? Let's pause for a moment. If you're like I was a decade ago, or like most people are when they first start thinking about these issues, then just about now you should be puzzled about something you hadn't thought through before. We live in a world that celebrates property. I'm one of those celebrants. I believe in the value of property in general, and I also believe in the value of that weird form of property that lawyers call intellectual property. A large, diverse society cannot survive without property. A large, diverse society and modern society cannot flourish without intellectual property. But it takes just a second's reflection to realize that there is plenty of value out there that property doesn't capture. I don't mean money can't buy you love, but rather value is plainly part of a process of production, including commercial as well as non-commercial production. If Disney animators had stolen a set of pencils to draw Steamboat Willie, We'd have no hesitation in condemning that taking as wrong, even though trivial, even if unnoticed. Yet there was nothing wrong, at least under the law of the day, with Disney's taking from Buster Keaton or from the Brothers Grimm. There was nothing wrong with taking from Keaton because Disney's use would have been considered fair. There was nothing wrong with the taking from the Grimms because the Grimms' work was in the public domain. Thus, even though the things that Disney took, or more generally, the things taken by anyone exercising Walt Disney creativity, are valuable, our tradition does not treat those takings as wrong. Some things remain free for the taking within a free culture, and that freedom is good. The same with the doujinshi culture. If a doujinshi artist broke into a publisher's office and ran off with 1,000 copies of his latest work, or even one copy, without paying, we'd have no hesitation in saying the artist was wrong. In addition to having trespassed, he would have stolen something of value. The law bans that stealing in whatever form, whether large or small. Yet there's an obvious reluctance, even among Japanese lawyers, to say that the copycat comic artists are stealing. This form of Walt Disney creativity is seen as fair and right, even if lawyers in particular find it hard to say why. It's the same with 1,000 examples that appear everywhere once you begin to look. Scientists build upon the work of other scientists without asking or paying for the privilege. Excuse me, Professor Einstein, but may I have permission to use your theory of relativity to show that you were wrong about quantum physics? Acting companies perform adaptations of the works of Shakespeare without securing permission from anyone. Does anyone believe Shakespeare would be better spread within our culture if there were a centralized Shakespeare rights clearinghouse that all productions of Shakespeare must appeal to first? And Hollywood goes through cycles with a certain kind of movie. 5 asteroid films in the late 1990s, 2 volcano disaster films in 1997. Creators here and everywhere are always and at all times building upon the creativity that went before and that surrounds them now. That building is always and everywhere, at least partially done, without permission and without compensating the original creator. No society, free or controlled, has ever demanded that every use be paid for, or that permission for Walt Disney creativity must always be sought. Instead, every society has left a certain bit of its culture free for the taking. Free societies more fully than unfree, perhaps, but all societies to some degree. The hard question is therefore not whether a culture is free. All cultures are free to some degree. The hard question instead is, how free is this culture? How much and how broadly is the culture free for others to take and build upon? Is that freedom limited to party members? To members of the royal family? To the top 10 corporations on the New York Stock Exchange? Or is that freedom spread broadly, to artists generally, whether affiliated with the Met or not, to musicians generally, whether white or not, to filmmakers generally, whether affiliated with a studio or not? Free cultures are cultures that leave a great deal open for others to build upon. Unfree or permission cultures leave much less. Ours was a free culture. It is becoming much less so.